It's been a week that most of our winter snow and ice has disappeared, melting and flowing into our rivers, lakes, and streams. So what has the harsh winter done to the health of our waterways and the fish that inhabit them? It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Rivers and streams are looking foamy and filthy. So what's going on? We'll find out and ask whether we can bid adieu to Old Man Winter. For that, political scientist Donna Hoffman on new polls that look at the 2014 Iowa Senate race and the 2016 presidential race. Also, details from a new Cancer in Iowa report, a new ad campaign for Iowa tourism, and some thoughts on Pi Day. No, not strawberry or apple. Buckle up for your Friday News Buzz after this news from NPR. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. A chance for us on Fridays to catch up on news with some quick conversations. Later in the hour, our rivers and streams, some of them are looking awfully foamy and filthy. What's going on? We'll find out and ask whether we can bid adieu to Old Man Winter. But first, a new Quinnipiac University poll was released. It looked at the 2016 presidential race in Iowa, showing significant changes since the last time that poll was taken in December. It also looked at the 2014 open Senate race in Iowa. Joining me now to talk about a few of the results, Donna Hoffman, associate professor and chair of political science at the University of Northern Iowa. Hi, Donna.
Hi, Ben.
Let's talk about the presidential hopefuls mentioned in this poll, polled here. We had Hillary Clinton being matched up against various hopefuls on the Republican side. What did we see?
Well, interestingly enough, you saw Hillary Clinton doing reasonably well against potential matchups with the potential Republican candidates that they polled against. You did see, of course, there has been a lot of buzz about Chris Christie out of New Jersey, and also the bridge scandal that has been going on there. And we saw a significant eroding in his poll numbers when matched up with Clinton that we saw in a previous poll. And so Clinton would, you know, quite easily at this point, which I should emphasize is quite early, would win in a head-to-head matchup against Chris Christie by a pretty substantial margin. She was at 48 and he would be at 35.
And prior to this bridge scandal, it was reversed. Christie was at one point polled to be ahead of Hillary.
Right. And he was really kind of seen as a rising up-and-coming star within the Republican Party, and especially for the 2016 race. But the bridge scandal has done some damage to him.
Mm-hmm. What is it about the bridge scandal that makes it so damaging? And you know, remind us, Chris Christie has not been directly implicated, even though his staff is on the hot seat, right?
Right. And I think it's kind of the general notion of, and especially in Iowa, I think this plays poorly for Christie, that the administration, I mean, he's kind of always had this persona of a bully. And this is kind of fed that notion a bit, even though it was people within the administration. He hasn't been directly implicated in it. It was his administration. And as we know, if you're at the presidential level and things happen with your administration, you're, you know, basically responsible. The notion of the buck stops here kind of thing. So, you know, Iowans tend to be not very don't look kindly on corruption. They like good government, and so we've seen some problems that Christie has had in his poll numbers in the state.
Mm-hmm. We had Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky win the recent last weekend's CPAC straw poll. Is he a leading contender when Christie's taken out of the picture?
He's certainly a contender. I don't know. I think it's too early to say he's a leading contender. And CPAC in particular is today pretty much dominated by the Libertarian faction mm-hmm. within the Republican Party, and he's certainly the leading libertarian-oriented candidate. And he certainly is not saying he's not going to run, and he's doing steps, in fact, that would make his run easier. For example, he's trying to get some laws changed in Kentucky so he could be simultaneously on the ballot and get that law changed so that he could both run for re-election for his Senate seat that would be up in 2016, as well as run for president if it should come to that.
And we have to mention here, you mentioned it's very early. Are any of these candidates mentioned in the poll even declared?
No, not really. I mean, you know, none of them are declared, no. And some of it's, you know, pure speculation. For example, they also polled on Jeb Bush. And, you know, if we look, though, you know, just in kind of a short-term history here, and Clinton is doing very well against all of these potential matchups, You know, she did very well against potential matchups when they were polling in 2006, 2007, too. Mm-hmm. And that didn't turn out to be the case that she was the, you know, going to be the Democratic nominee. She was seen as being the person to beat, and she was beatable. So it is still very early to put much stock in these numbers. But, you know, the other thing is that the Quinnipiac poll didn't poll on any other Democrat. I mean, they did ask a question about Joe Biden, but it was just basically, do you think he would make a good president? They didn't put him with any potential matchups with Republicans either. It was just Clinton. And so she really is kind of seen as being the person to beat here, even though she's not declared. Nobody else has declared either.
Mm-hmm. We will look at, you mentioned Rand Paul polled here. Ted Cruz also polled. We didn't mention him. Jeb Bush, you mentioned him. So when we talk about Chris Christie, is the damage done by the bridge controversy, do you think, irreversible?
I don't think it's irreversible because voters have a short memory, quite frankly. And, you know, there hasn't been a lot of attention given to it in the last month or so, or the last couple of weeks, I should say, probably. It will fade from voters' minds. If nothing else comes out on that, then, you know, it is something that may, in fact, not be that big of a deal going down the pike. At the same time, it does still have the potential to be this lingering scandal that continues to put a question mark in voters' minds about his suitability to govern.
Former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton at the head, dominating this poll in Iowa of presidential hopefuls. But President Obama's approval rating isn't faring well in the eyes of Iowans, according to this new poll. A low approval rating doesn't seem to be hurting the former member of his administration, Hillary Clinton, at all, does it?
No, it doesn't really seem to be. But again, you know, Clinton is a known quantity. And, you know, with polling this early, it's kind of squishy, if you will. That's a technical term. And and so, you know, Obama's effect on down ticket races, for example, with the Senate, didn't seem to affect his low approval in the state, didn't seem to affect any of Braley's numbers either. And, you know, again, voters typically can segment and the fact that, you know, he's not going to be on the ballot again doesn't always have to affect things that are happening down the ballot or mm-hmm. even in a subsequent presidential race in several years.
Nevertheless, how do you expect Hillary Clinton, should she declare, how do you expect her to distance herself from President Obama should his approval ratings remain relatively low, having been once part of his administration? It's a fine line to walk, isn't it?
It is kind of a fine line to walk. But, you know, she was in the administration on the foreign policy side of it. And, you know, there's still a lot of things that are developing there, of course. I mean, I think the big question will be what she says, what she does in terms of the Affordable Care Act, and whether she gives it a full-throated support, whether she says she supports it but it needs changes. Those are basically the only two options, I think, for her. But it will be interesting to see how she would position herself on that issue. And she's being, you know, particularly cagey, both on foreign policy at the moment, as well as any domestic policy issues, because it's just too early to see how those things are going to affect a potential race in 2016.
Do you see the issue of Benghazi, the attack on the consulate in Libya, that is still seen in some media, as a vulnerability? Or is that only a talking point, a vulnerability in, well, Republican voters?
I really think that it's, you know, only going to matter to people who probably wouldn't vote for Hillary Clinton anyway. There's been nothing else forthcoming on that. And it does seem to kind of be a dead issue with mainstream voters, certainly not with hardcore Republican voters. They see that as kind of a rallying cry. But, you know, she has addressed it. She has, you know, she was before congressional committees on it and testified. She, in an interview relatively recently, said that was, you know, her biggest regret was that. But unless something else were to come out of that, you know, we would be, again, several years off of that particular episode. I don't see it doing damage with independent voters or certainly with Democrats. But, you know, again, it is going to be something that lingers in the minds, I think, of Republicans, but they're not likely to vote for her anyway.
Mm-hmm. Donna Hoffman, before we have to go very quickly, the poll also looked at the open Senate race for the seat of retiring Senator Tom Harkin, Democratic Congressman Bruce Braley, with, it seems, a pretty good lead over several potential rivals. What do you see in this polling?
Yeah, and again, Braley, kind of like Hillary Clinton, she benefits from being the only Democrat they're asking questions about. He's the only, he's seen as being the de facto Democratic Party nominee for the U.S. Senate race. So there's not infighting within the Democratic Party for the nomination, whereas on the Republican side, there are several people vying for that particular nomination spot. And as a result of that, Braley does, you know, relatively well against the potential Republican challengers. He's also the person in the race, when you include the Republican hopefuls, that, you know, has held federal office. He's been a member of the House of Representatives, and the other ones have held various offices or no offices at all. Mm-hmm. And so they're not as well known.
Let's mention them. U.S. Attorney Matt Whitaker, State Senator Joni Ernst, a businessman, Mark Jacobs, and a radio personality, commentator Sam Clovis there. Yeah.
Right. And Braley, has a 12-point lead on his closest one, which would be Matt Whitaker. So Braley was polling at 42% over Matt Whitaker's 30. But, you know, for all of the matchups that they did, those four that you mentioned, there's still 25% basically who don't know. So people are a lot of people are yet to pay attention really to this race. The primary for the Republicans will be in June. And so there's still a lot of room to move and for this to change because there's not a lot of attention to it yet. And so, you know, there could be some things that happen there.
Mm-hmm. Certainly, these poll numbers for 2014 more relevant than for 2016, because when you look at, well, the 2016 numbers in this poll, certainly poured over by political analysts such as yourself and pundits on various media outlets. But how much value do such polls have, for instance, on the 2016 race, 2 years before the Iowa caucuses, before anyone has declared? Isn't it always the case that something happens to shake up the picture significantly?
It often can be the case. And again, I would point to, 2008. Clinton was seen as being the person to beat. And then again, it turned out that she was beatable. And Iowa played a significant role in that. You know, she's being particularly cagey about what her plans are, but certainly behind the scenes, there are a lot of her supporters that are mobilizing. But yeah, polling at this point for a 2016 race is quite problematic in terms of, it just doesn't tell us a whole lot. It tells us that Hillary Clinton is a known quantity, which we already knew, and that there has yet to be any kind of coalescing behind any particular Republican in a matchup with her.
Donna Hoffman, Associate Professor and Chair of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa. Always great to get your insights, Donna. Thank you.
Thanks, Ben.
Glad you're with us along for the ride on this News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Still to come in our second half hour, details on a new Cancer in Iowa report, a new ad campaign we'll hear about for Iowa tourism, and some thoughts on Pi Day, which is today. Get it? 314, 3.14, what does it go, 5, 6, 9. No, I'm not sure. I can't go past that. We'll find out about that at the end of the hour. But first, biking to work, I crossed the Iowa River in Iowa City, and midweek I looked over a bridge over the river and saw what, at first glance, I was thinking were large sections of ice floating down the river. In fact, those large white patches were foam. Yuck! Perhaps you had the same reaction seeing a waterway during this week of snow and ice melt. Joining me now to talk about the health of our rivers and the creatures that inhabit them, Jim Wall, Northwest Regional Fishery Supervisor for the DNR, based in Spirit Lake. Hi, Jim.
Oh, hi, Ben.
Looks like a chemical factory spilled into the river that I crossed earlier this week, a foamy filth floating down the water. What is that? Should we be concerned?
No, you really shouldn't. It does look much worse than what it is, but that foam, Ben, is dissolved organic matter, and the source of it comes from the surrounding watershed or the soils that drain to our rivers and streams, and it's particularly noticeable during the spring, during snow melt, and what happens is there's decaying and decomposition of plant material, leaves, grass, that the water is percolating through and then transporting, and once it goes to the stream, then if it goes over an area that is particularly turbulent, like a riffle or a rapids or over a dam, it seems to be more prevalent, in a situation like that.
Mm-hmm.
The foam's not toxic, in a natural sense. It's usually light tan or brownish in color and kind of earthy, or has kind of a fishy type odor. Now, if it was truly a pollution type event, which possibly could occur, but it's rare, it would be very white in color and more fragrant odor, like soapy or perfume, just mm-hmm. like you'd get foam off of washing your hands, you know, with detergent.
Well, I just looked over the bridge. I didn't go down and give it a sniff, so I guess I can't answer that question. Is it okay to eat fish from the rivers and lakes that look like this?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, no, it's typically no problem whatsoever as far as that goes with this. You might have noticed a brownish color mm-hmm. as well, and that also is from this organic matter, which is the decaying or decomposition of plant matter, and it'll typically give the water a coloration of yellowish-brown or maybe even a tea color, and that comes from tannins that are leaching into the water from tree roots or decaying vegetation. For your listeners that might go up to Canada and fish up in the up north, you frequently see tannic stained waters from pine needles in the bog type situation where it's leaching through those types of plant material.
I understand that you're getting reports of that many pond owners, ice fishermen around the state, have been noticing dead fish. What's this due to?
Well, we've been experiencing one of the most difficult winters throughout the state from longevity and severity of cold. Some of our waters up here in the northern part of the state have had ice since mid or late November, so we're going on 3 to 3.5 months of ice cover with some heavy snow cover. And under those conditions, light penetration does not happen, so the aquatic plants within those lakes, the photosynthesis discontinues. So the volume, the oxygen that's there in those lakes has to be sufficient to support fish life throughout the remainder of the winter. We are hearing some reports from private pond owners that they're concerned about the loss of fish, and we do anticipate there'll be some of that. In the public bodies of water, our DNR Fisheries Bureau staff monitor oxygen levels, and although we do have some that are quite low right now, we do have most of our lakes, should come through the winter with adequate oxygen levels to support those fish life.
Mm-hmm. So how long does it take for fish stock to bounce back after that type of winter?
Fish are pretty resilient. Unfortunately, in some situations, the more desirable fish, your bass, bluegill, crappie, perch, walleye, those species are less tolerant to low DOs, and your species are not preferred, like a carp or a bullhead, are more tolerant. So if you have a fish community that has those species in it, then you may have a situation that could be particularly detrimental or tough to remedy. Under most situations, if you have a good, healthy fish population, the die-off is generally not complete. It's an incomplete situation and quite often doesn't even require any restocking, so the fish will come back on their own.
Mm-hmm. Of course, this winter, due to the harshness, the number of snowfalls, a lot of ice being treated with salt and other chemicals that eventually finds its way into our sewers and much of it flowing right into our rivers. What is the effect of all those things that we put on our roads and sidewalks on our fish population?
Usually not a large impact. They could have a very small isolated impact where if a fish were in an area where they were trapped and exposed to something like that, it may create a problem or situation. But generally speaking, that doesn't pose a threat to our fish populations. Or the of a greater concern is the lack of oxygen, not always in streams, but more so in lakes, that is, a naturally occurring process, and that would ultimately, create a greater concern or greater problem for fisheries.
Before we go, what does the harsh winter mean for the summer in terms of the waterways, lakes, rivers, and streams in Iowa? Any difference this year than last summer?
We've been in a drought cycle, depending upon where you're at in the state, for the last couple years. Up in my region in northwest Iowa, some of our lakes, our natural lakes, were going into the winter 2 years ago close to 3 feet below crest. That was softened some this past year, and most of the lakes going into this year's winter were within 1 foot of crest, so they were below normal, but close. So really the water and streams are vulnerable to this as well. So, with low water, and although the drought isn't as severe as it was 2 years ago, and the severe winter, it can create a situation where there could be some loss of fish. Typically, though, I don't think that we're going to have too much problem coming out of this current winter. And hopefully, our fish populations will be fine, and there'll be plenty of fish for anglers to catch once the ice goes off this spring.
Very good. Northwest Regional Fishery Supervisor for the DNR, Jim Wall, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
Let's spend a couple minutes before the break to talk about our weather outlook. Kevin Scow is with us again, meteorologist at the National Weather Service based in Des Moines. Hi, Kevin.
Hello.
What a nice day we have today. So do we shut the door, say goodbye for good for this season anyway to Old Man Winter?
It's a little too early to do that at this point. It's still only the middle of March, and we could still easily see another major snowstorm here, easily into early April. And as you guys might remember from just last year, we had that big snowstorm at the beginning of May, so it's certainly anything's possible through this spring, the beginning of spring.
Anything that we can see in our immediate forecast, though, as far as snowfall?
We do have one system that's coming down, a cold front tracking down Saturday night through Sunday morning, and that could bring upwards of an inch or so of slushy, wet snow to portions of central Iowa.
Okay. Well, we know whatever comes our way, it can't last all that long, right?
No, the ground temps have warmed up substantially the last couple of days, and that'll help melt off any of the snow that does fall.
Okay, so we move into severe weather season. When does that start?
Well, there's really not a start date for severe weather season. We've seen severe weather across the state as early as, February or even earlier. But generally, especially for, say, tornadoes, our tornado, when we generally tend to see the most tornadoes, is from late March through May or early June. So that's, but we've seen tornadoes at all months of the year here in Iowa.
Mm-hmm. And very quickly, before we go, does this, the weather patterns we have right now, can they predict whether our severe weather will be greater or less than past years?
Yeah, unfortunately, it's a little hard to tell at this point. We've had a pretty fortunate severe weather season the last couple of years where our tornado numbers have been quite a bit below this average, but we should definitely pay attention to that here in the upcoming couple months.
Okay, Kevin Scow, meteorologist at the National Weather Service based in Des Moines. Thanks for the update.
Hey, thank you.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We're going to take a short break and be back. When we do come back, we'll learn about details from a new Cancer in Iowa report. We'll find out where progress has been made in the treatment of cancer, also prevention of cancer. Some tips of that when we come back. A new ad campaign for Iowa tourism. We'll learn about that and some thoughts on Pi Day. It's 314, 3.14159. I don't remember the rest of it. It's a number that goes on into infinity. We'll find out why it's celebrated today. It's your Friday News Buzz. I'm Ben Kiefer, back with more in just a minute. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, a News Buzz edition on this Friday. I'm Ben Kiefer. Last year, over 6,400 Iowans died from cancer. 17,400, approximately, were diagnosed with cancer. And about a quarter of the deaths were due to lung cancer. That's according to the new Cancer in Iowa report published annually by the State Health Registry of Iowa. It's based at the University of Iowa's College of Public Health. Dr. Chuck Lynch is the medical director of the registry. He's also professor of epidemiology at the University of Iowa's Carver College of Medicine. He joins us now in the studio. Dr. Lynch, welcome.
Thank you, Ben.
What do you see as most noteworthy in this latest report?
Well, I think people should recognize that in Iowa and the nation, there are four cancers that explain about 50% of all cancer deaths and about 50% of all newly diagnosed cancers, if we exclude the common skin cancers that registries typically do not collect information on. Those four cancer sites are lung cancer, prostate cancer, female breast cancer, and cancer of the large bowel, or we call it colorectal cancer.
Mm-hmm. And lung cancer causing more deaths than any other cancer in Iowa. Why is that so common, given the fact that people have reduced smoking significantly?
Well, the rates for lung cancer are coming down. But it takes 20 to 30 years once we start seeing changes in tobacco rates to really see changes in the lung cancer rates. So there's a what we call a long latent period here from exposure to development of disease. We have been seeing declines in male lung cancer since the 1980s here in Iowa, but the female cancer rates are just peaking out now. That's because smoking became common in men during and after World War I, and it only became common in women after World War II.
Mm-hmm. Let's say I'm 50, 60 years old. I smoked in my 20s or 30s, but have not smoked for a couple of decades at least. Do I still have a risk of lung cancer due to the smoking that I engaged in several decades ago?
The two leading causes of death that we see in Iowa today are heart disease and cancer. Lung cancer is the leading cause of cancer death. If you stop smoking, and it's never too late to stop, your risk of heart disease declines fairly quickly related to that, within a few years. It usually takes a decade or more to see reductions in lung cancer risk, so it takes a much longer period of time.
We know that radon, this invisible gas, a radioactive gas that comes from our ground, is a big problem here in Iowa especially. Can we know how many lung cancer cases are caused by the radon problem in Iowa?
The estimate in Iowa that, like this year, we'll see about 1,700 deaths due to lung cancer. The estimate is about 400 of those would be due to radon. Radon is the second leading cause of lung cancer in the state of Iowa, second to smoking.
What about secondhand smoke?
Well, secondhand smoke is thought to also be an important cause of heart disease and lung cancer, but the number of cases would not surpass that of either radon or of smoking directly.
This year's study, I see, focused on cervical cancer. Why?
We wanted to, this year, talk about human papillomavirus-related cancers. The leading site for that is cervical cancer in women. And because of the importance of this disease worldwide, a vaccine was developed and approved by the Food and Drug Administration in 2006 here. It was called Gardasil at that time. And then two, 3 years later, another vaccine was developed called Cervarix. We've also found out that human papillomavirus is very important in other cancers in the anogenital area, the vagina, the vulva, the penis, and the anus. And even more recently, we found that tumors in the back of the throat, particularly at the base of the tongue and the tonsils, are also quite frequently human papillomavirus-related in their cause. We wanted to tell the public about this because the vaccine has been underutilized in this country and in the state of Iowa. It's a vaccine that is recommended for boys and girls beginning at ages 11 and 12. And the reason we want to start early is because the vaccine is most effective if it's given before there's any exposure to human papillomavirus.
Mm-hmm. What do you see as the reasons that the vaccine is underutilized in Iowa and across the nation?
Probably how you contract the virus is very important and why people are hesitant to get vaccinated. This is a sexually transmitted virus. So multiple sexual partners, anal intercourse, oral sex, these are the known ways that people get exposed to human papillomavirus. So there are some concerns on the part of parents that if they get their child vaccinated, they're going to become more promiscuous. There's no evidence, really, that that's going to happen, but that's a concern that they have. Another concern is, at the national level, is that healthcare providers have not been pushing this vaccine enough as they see children in the offices. So there's a national campaign going on right now to try and make providers more aware of the need to get this vaccine out, not only to girls now, but to boys as well.
This is the 11th year the cancer report has been published by the State Health Registry of Iowa, I believe. Where have we seen in the years of this report, the decade or so, the greatest progress in the fight against cancer and improvement in cancer treatment?
We've seen declines in cancer death rates, overall cancer death rates, since the early 1990s in the state of Iowa. And fortunately, right now, some of the greatest progress is being made with the big four cancer sites that I mentioned earlier. So we're seeing declines in breast cancer mortality among women. We're seeing declines in prostate, lung cancer, and colorectal cancer. Mm-hmm. The declines are not as steep as what we're seeing with heart disease. So we're on the verge in Iowa and in other states of seeing cancer become the number one cause of death, surpassing heart disease, which will be the first time that that's ever happened in the time that we've been recording causes of death as a nation.
What do you see for individuals? What can an individual do who has no cancer, is cancer-free at the moment, an adult, do the easiest way to prevent cancer in the future?
Well, research would indicate that the most important thing we can do to reduce our risk of cancer is pay attention to our lifestyle factors. So we've already discussed today the leading cause of cancer in the country, smoking. So tobacco cessation is very important. Alcohol is also related to several cancer sites, particularly in the upper aerodigestive area. So alcohol in moderation and not in excess is important. And for many people, it's very hard for them to do that. If they start drinking, it's very hard to stop. And the third thing is our diet, essentially. We need to eat more fruits and vegetables and less fatty foods. And that type of behavior, along with obesity, is also related to several cancer sites. If we did those things, we would cut down the number of cancers by more than half over time.
Mentioned in the report, over 17,000 new diagnosed cases of cancer in Iowa. Attitudes have changed about cancer in the last decade, and more than the last decade. We have certainly more discussion of cancer survivors, more people. So is that something you trace with your registry or think about?
Yes. Every newly diagnosed case that we have in the registry, we follow to death so that we can compute survival rates, the various types of cancer that people are diagnosed for. This becomes very helpful to physicians in that as well, so they can answer that question for a patient. Doc, how long do I have to live, when they're given a serious diagnosis? But many people today still fear the word cancer, thinking if they hear it in regard to their health, they're going to die from that. In fact, that's not true. The vast majority of patients today survive their cancer and live a life that averts them dying from that particular cancer during their lifetime.
Dr. Charles Lynch, Medical Director of the State Health Registry of Iowa, based at the University of Iowa's College of Public Health. Dr. Lynch, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Earlier this week, Governor Terry Branstad used his weekly news conference to talk up a new Iowa tourism ad campaign. And in response to questions, however, he sheepishly acknowledged that he and his wife were packing their bags to get out of the state. They're bound for a vacation in Arizona. However, the plans he announced before flying off to that sun and warmth were for a $1.5 million advertising buy. And get this, it's aimed at visitors from Chicago, Minneapolis, St. Paul, Kansas City, and Omaha. Joining us to talk about this new ad campaign, Shauna Lodi is the manager of the Iowa Tourism Office. Hi, Shauna.
Hello there. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Why is this tourism ad buy aimed at these cities that I named?
Well, Iowa is really fortunate because we're right smack in the middle of some highly populated areas, like you mentioned, Chicago, Minneapolis, Kansas City, Omaha. So we want to say to those people, hey, did you know that you could come to Iowa? You can come here easily. You can drive your car. It won't take long. Bring your family. You're not going to spend a lot of money here, but you're going to make a memory that lasts a lifetime.
Mm-hmm. So what, the obvious question, what do Chicagoans or those in the Twin Cities not have that we can offer them in Iowa for an excursion that lasts a few days?
Well, I think that whether Iowa has it and another place has it doesn't really matter. We're always looking to experience something that's away from our own home, something that we've never done before. And I think that Iowa's got a lot of great destinations that don't exist anywhere else. The trick is letting people know that the National Mississippi River Museum in Dubuque is actually a Smithsonian-affiliated museum, or that Iowa is the only state in the country that you can visit that's bordered by two navigable rivers. Certainly the Mississippi River on our eastern border is a beautiful destination, as is the Missouri River on our western border and the Lus Hills that accompany it.
How much does tourism mean to our state's economy, Shauna?
Travelers in Iowa spend upwards of $8 billion here every year, and they also generate about $300 million in tax revenue. And what's great about that is that travelers are our best taxpayers because they're coming into our state, they're leaving behind tax revenue, and that revenue is funding public services that we all take advantage of, but we don't have to pay for it. Travelers do.
Mm-hmm. Now, I have to believe, because of my experience being in Iowa and traveling outside of the state to other parts of the country, also other parts of the world, that one of the big draws of Iowa is the people of our state. Iowans are known for being friendly and accommodating.
You're right. And when a traveler says to us, how do I get from point A to point B, an Iowan will always kindly tell them. And, you know, the trick isn't people like Iowa when they come here. They're surprised by what they find. They love the people, as you said. So the hard part is getting people here in the first place. We find over and over again that once someone experiences our state, it's easy to bring them back. What we need to do is to convince them to come for the first time.
How is this latest Iowa Tourism Ad campaign different than previous ones?
You know, we're spending a lot more money to reach people digitally. We know that advertising on mobile devices, tablets, and phones, that's really where people are going now to get their travel information. So we're trying to use a lot more digital advertising to reach people when they're thinking about what their travel plans might be.
Do you do surveys, research about people's conceptions of Iowa, perhaps misconceptions of Iowa?
We do. We actually did our most recent set of focus groups and online surveys about a year and a half ago. And you know what we find isn't that people have a bad impression of Iowa. It's that they don't have any impression of Iowa. So, you know, that's good news and bad news. It means that we can show them just about anything, and they might not know that it exists here.
What about the future of Iowa tourism? Where do you hope to lead this in the future?
We think the future is very bright. The trend continues to be, again, that people are looking for shorter trips and they're looking to take those trips more often. It's so typical now that both parents are working, that kids are involved in lots of activities, so the time to take a two-week trip, that just doesn't happen so much anymore. So what people want are those 3 and 4 day weekends that they can take advantage of maybe, you know, 3, maybe 4 times throughout the year. So again, we want to reach those metropolitan areas that surround Iowa and tell them that when they've got some time, they've got a little bit of money, that Iowa is here and ready to welcome them.
Okay, let's say I'm someone in Kansas City or Omaha or the Twin Cities or Chicago, and you've got my attention. Where can you point me to some of the jewels that are hidden in our state?
Iowa is such a great biking destination. Ragbri, obviously the event that most people know about, but so many wonderful trails and rides for folks of all ages and abilities, and that's certainly something, a message that we try to share with our visitors from out of state.
Shauna Lodi, thank you for spending a few minutes with us, Iowa Tourism Manager. We appreciate it.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Thanks for joining us on this News Buzz here on River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Ben Kiefer. Let's get an update on a new project we have going on here at Iowa Public Radio News. It's a project that looks to investigate emergency room hospital costs. And joining me now, one of my two colleagues who are heading up this project, IPR's Emily Woodbury, who is a talk show producer. She's doing this new project together with Iowa Public Radio reporter Duri Buscarin. Hi, Emily.
Hi, Ben. Thanks for having me today.
So remind us, what is this project you're working on?
So the project is called Investigate This, ER Costs. Everyone has a story about the emergency room. It's a really emotional time. You know, you really refer the decision-making to the doctors. There's little time to ask questions about the cost of care you're receiving. And oftentimes the physicians and care providers you're working with either, you know, A, don't know the sticker price of a procedure they're suggesting, or B, you know, they don't know how much your insurance is going to cover. So you can end up with a really high bill at the end of your stay at the ER. So our ultimate goal is to answer the question, why is my emergency bill so high? And we're taking listener stories and questions, and we're going to take these to the experts, to hospital administrators, to physicians, and find out where these costs are coming from.
So you're looking to hear from who?
So we want to hear from listeners, from Iowans, from everyone who has been caught off guard by an itemized bill they received from the ER. And we want you to tell us about a time you went to the emergency room, either as a patient or bill payer, and tell us what your bill looked like. We want you to tell us what charges stood out to you.
Mm-hmm. We've been hearing the announcements periodically throughout the day on Iowa Public Radio. What have you received so far as a response?
We had a response from Seamus in Dubuque. He went to the ER because he needed stitches in his hand, 7 sutures. And the sticker price for the procedure was around $500. His insurance only covered about $30 of it. And he said since that occasion, he had a circumstance where he required about 3 stitches. He thoroughly washed, stitched, and protected the site. 3 weeks later, he found he had no paperwork to complete, no infection, and as he says, best of all, I was $500 richer. Since then, I've had great cause to reevaluate the benefit of going to the ER unless it is a true emergency. And we saw that in a lot of the stories that we received from people that, you know, for the smaller procedures in the ER, the not life-threatening ones, they actually would have done things differently had they known the cost ahead of time. I mean, we heard other stories, you know, people in for more serious accidents. You know, things can range from thousands and thousands of dollars for a scan, a brain scan, or, you know, a couple $100 for stitches. You know, we got this one response from Martha in Iowa City saying, the ER is the most vulnerable place for a patient. I was jostled by the accident and was in no condition to be asking critical questions. I felt at their mercy. They could charge anything, order any test. Was I really in a position to question them?
Obviously, you've struck a chord with listeners, and you're still looking for others. Tell us again how people can get in touch with you and Dury if they've had an emergency room experience that they'd like to share.
Yeah, so if some of these stories stand out to you, if you've had similar experiences, we want to hear, A, about your experience, what your bill looked like, you know, how much it cost you, and any questions you have. Even if you just have a question, you don't necessarily have a story, you can email us at investigatethis@iowapublicradio.org. Again, that's an email address, a new email address, investigatethis@iowapublicradio.org. Or you can join our Public Insight Network. You can find that on your website. There's a button at the bottom of our webpage, iowapublicradio.org. And once you click on the Public Insight Network, you can join the query and just answer a couple questions about your stay in the hospital room and tell us, you know, your story. Tell us your questions.
Okay, the email address to go to write about your experience, investigatethis@iowapublicradio.org. Iowa Public Radio's Emily Woodbury. Thanks for the update.
Thank you, Ben.
And finally today is Pi Day. It was Archimedes, a Greek mathematician, engineer, astronomer, and inventor who came up with the theoretical number of pi. The number pi is a mathematical constant. It's the ratio of a circle circumference to its diameter, and it's irrational. In mathematical speak, that means it goes on into infinity without repeating. There's no pattern, no matter how far you go. Thanks to supercomputers, pi has been calculated over 1 trillion digits. And the Science Center in Des Moines has celebrated today 314, get it, 3.14, as Pi Day. For how long? Emily Richardson is marketing manager at the Science Center of Iowa. How long have you been doing this?
We've been celebrating now for a few years, but just last year and this year are really big celebrations. It's gained a lot of steam in the public, and we just love it because we get to celebrate math and science and share that with our audiences.
What's planned for this afternoon?
Well, today at 3:14 p.m., we will be doing a pie plosion. We built something that sort of looks like a pie on a picnic table, but underneath that, there's a big trash bucket that we filled with red balls that look like cherries. We're going to do a liquid nitrogen in 2-liter bottle, and it basically is a huge explosion that looks like a massive cherry pie that's exploding.
I hope you're going to get that on video and put it online.
Definitely. Then tonight we have our family night. It's also the reopening of one of our exhibits. It was sponsored by Dahl's Foods. So we're partnering with Tippin's Pies. And the first 314 people through our doors after 5 p.m. today will get a free slice of pie.
Mmm, sounds good. We have just a minute or so left. I wonder how many digits of pie can you recite by memory?
3.1415926653. And the reason I know that is because next year is going to be amazing. March 14th, 2015, 9:26 in the morning. It's going to be great.
Okay. All right. We'll look forward to that. Thank you for joining us. And anybody can join you at the Science Center today at what time?
Anytime all day. Our big explosion, pie-plosion, is at 3:14, and then family night tonight is from 5 to 8 p.m.
Emily Richardson, marketing manager at the Science Center of Iowa. We have a little bit of pie put to music here to end our program. Thanks, Emily.
Thank you.
River to River is produced by, there it goes, Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Let's see how far this singer has memorized the number four. I'm off next week. Have a great weekend. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. 2 8 4 1 1 7 4 5 0 2 8 4 1 0 2 7 0 1